Good morning, everyone. I'm Ben Pearson. Before we get to Queenstown Airport, I just have a matter I want to raise with Mr. Barr. And clearly a message for you to pass on to Ms. Banks, Mr. Barr. The questions we were asking yesterday regarding the definition of building and the additional clause that was added to it about the temporary use of, amongst other things, shipping containers. It occurs to me that Ms. Banks would be wise to consider whether, in fact, that clause would be better dealt with as a temporary activity rule rather than trying to deal with it within the definition, because that, I'm a bit concerned that the way that definition is drafted, it could have unforeseen consequences throughout the district.
The definition of building with a component around it?
Yes, because it says that, it effectively says that shipping containers are not buildings in certain circumstances. I think the intention is not that. The intention is that shipping containers can be used for temporary accommodation for up to a certain amount of time and not comply with the setback requirements. And that was all.
Yes.
I think that needs to be clearly expressed that way rather than the other way.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. I'll pass it on.
Now, Ms. Foy.
Thank you. To check you've received pre-lodged evidence and
yes.
Any questions?
Yes,
thank
and
you.
We have pre-read them as well.
Thank you. Propose to deal with, well, obviously, my legal submissions, deal with QAC submissions on all three chapters, and you may have questions in relation to that, but in terms of order, subject to what you think, propose to have Mr. Roberts, after following my submissions, Mr. Roberts, Mr. Day, and then Mr. Roberts and
yes.
Mr. Day's evidence only relates to chapter 36.
As I understand it, having from the council's evidence yesterday, I don't think there's any dispute with Mr. Roberts' evidence. I might be wrong, but I think there's areas of dispute have been narrowed sufficiently to the issues between Dr. Chalmers and Mr. Day.
I don't think that's entirely correct based on what was set out in Dr. Charles's summary. It's just a couple of minor issues which
yes.
But
the point is Dr. Charles is a noise expert, he's not a ventilation expert. The issue of dispute is where you measure the noise from the ventilation system. That was the only matter
two other issues. One is Mr. Roberts can accept and agrees with Dr. Charles' position on that. One is the low setting and what that should be, whether that should be 0.35 or 0.5, and Dr. Charles has recommended that it should be at least 0.5, and there's some difficulty with the words at least, which Mr. Roberts can just briefly explain when he presents the summary. So that's a minor issue. But the more significant issue, which is sort of particularly significant issue, in fact, there are two others, is the heat pump, where a heat pump is provided, whether the high setting also needs to be provided. Dr. Charles misunderstood Mr. Roberts' evidence on that issue, so and has recommended that Mr. Roberts' evidence not be accepted. It's their issue, which Mr. Roberts will also address. And also
that was the issue about whether the become pressurized and affect such things as open fire.
No, that's a different issue.
That's the third issue, isn't it?
No, that's not that. There's, I don't think that that is an issue. I think it's a better path should be provided. The third issue is something that arises from Ms. Evans' Section 42A report, which is whether existing systems, whether the rule should expressly state that existing systems can be considered when compliance is being assessed. So whether you can take those into account.
Do you need a rule to do that?
Expressly state that. Well, it's just to clarify, well, it's a note in the rule to clarify that you can take that into account, because otherwise, potentially, you could construe the rule. So you need to, in order to satisfy it, you need to provide all the, provide all the, or address all the aspects of the rule by the new system. And so the rule, the intent of the note is just to clarify that if you've got an existing system there which does some of these things, you don't need to duplicate it with the new system in order to achieve compliance with the table.
If you, if a rule requires that you meet a standard, and you have a system that meets the standard, why?
It's not something we're going to argue in any substantive way. It was really just for an avoidance of doubt and out of an abundance of caution, I guess, to ensure that the position was clearly stated. But the panel's view is that that's implicit in the law.
I think it's implicit in any standard. Not just ventilation systems, any standard anywhere on the planet can comply if your existing system is the same with the ORC rules on clean air. If you've got a clean air system, you comply with the rules, even if they now say you have to upgrade, you don't need to if you meet the standard.
Yes, I take your point.
Okay, what I was trying to get to is I don't think we need to spend a lot of time with Mr. Rob.
Okay, that's good to hear, because it is quite complicated once you start getting into the details. So, if there's little of an issue, then
we would be prefer to just focus on the areas of dispute, because I think that's. We're dealing with technical evidence and technical matters that the technical experts have agreed on in large part, then there's no reason for us to deviate from that agreement. It's just the areas in dispute that we need to deal with.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Roberts addresses those areas in his summary statement.
Right, that's
good. Okay. Okay, so if I just. I'll just take you to, at the summary of my legal submissions, which is paragraph 104. I'll just address that briefly before we commence with the evidence. So my submission, the legal submissions and evidence pre-lodged for QAC and further evidence you'll hear today will demonstrate that Chapter 30 requires amendment to ensure its general provisions do not override and render nugatory the more specific airport-related provisions of Chapter 17. The appropriateness of the Chapter 17 provisions has been scrutinised in detail in the Section 32 evaluation for that chapter, whereas other than that undertaken by Ms. O'Sullivan, there appears to have been no scrutiny at all of the Chapter 30 provisions insofar as they relate to and potentially constrain activities at Queenstown and Wanaka airports. Just to interpolate here and note that the Section 32 evaluation of Chapter 30 is that it is enabling for utilities, however the converse is true for the district's airports. Chapter 30 is disenabling, but those costs are not assessed and it seems not appreciated by the Council. Paragraph 106. Given the regional importance of these airports as significant infrastructure and the economic and social benefits they contribute to the district's community, it is imperative in my submission the amendment to clarification note 30.3.3.3 is made as sought by QAC. two flat year. This amendment would clarify that the provisions of Chapter 30 do not prevail over the bespoke airport-specific provisions of Chapter 17. Similarly, in terms of Chapter 35, given the importance of the airports, it is necessary to ensure that the proposed plan appropriately brings to the attention of plan users and those administering it the need to comply with the airport's obstacle limitation services so as to ensure airports can continue to operate safely and efficiently. And I note that agreement between the Section 42A reporting officer, Ms. Banks, and Mr. Sullivan appears to have been generally reached on this issue. Finally, various amendments are required to Chapter 36 of the proposed plan to ensure it appropriately, efficiently and effectively addresses airport noise-related matters, both to maintain residents' amenity and to ensure that the airports are appropriately protected from potential reverse sensitivity effects. Additionally, to ensure the approach to airport and airport-related noise is clear and consistent across the proposed plan. And I just note here that QAC's original submission was that noise from land-based activities at Queensland Airport should be managed through appropriate noise rules within the airport mixed-use zone chapter, Chapter 17, noting that the proposed plan contains restrictive noise provisions for the airport, one at Chapter 17, one at Chapter 36, which are not quite the same. The Section 42A recommendation was that noise provisions of Chapter 17 should be deleted on the basis that such approach would be consistent with that taken generally by the proposed plan and would leave that all noise provisions were contained within the one chapter in Chapter 36. QAC's evidence proceeds on the basis of that recommendation. However, I note that Chapter 36 doesn't address all zones and the Section 32 evaluation states the noise limits for the town centre zones, local shopping zones and the business mix use zones have not been included in this chapter, given that these rules are complex and closely associated with the activities taking place in their zone, and that's the last page of the Section 32 report. And so, on my permission, given the numerous problems with the drafting the structure of Chapter 36, which have been touched on by Ms. Today and Ms. O'Sullivan, and maybe address in further detail today, to exclude the airport mixed use zone from Chapter 36 and instead deal with the relevant noise provisions in the course of hearing submissions on Chapter 17 would be desirable. And this would be consistent with the approach taken in the other business zones and also with QAC's original submission. So really what I'm saying here is perhaps the way to deal with these issues for the airport is to go back to the relief in QAC's original submission to deal with the noise provisions in the course of the Chapter 17 hearing, because there's a noise rule in that chapter already. And from QAC's perspective, that means that the issues that generally with the chapter 36 in general, at least that can just, it doesn't need to get caught up in those.
Just on that point, I suppose the first query I have about the noise generated in the airport mixed use zone, why can that zone have greater noise levels imposed on the surrounding areas than any other zone?
As I understand, this is addressed in the Section 2 assessment for Chapter 17. And Marshall Day Acoustics did noise assessment, which is formed part of that Section 2 assessment. And the view was reached that the different noise levels are consistent with the designation, the airport's designation, but also with the noise levels in the surrounding zones. As I understand it, and Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Day can probably address you in further detail on this, and perhaps more accurately.
Well, I'll ask Mr. Day as well. I'm just wondering, given that, and it may be an issue with the way that the plan is drafted, but it certainly says that noise received, for example, in the residential zones, is not exceed 50 dBA from all sources, except the airport mixed use zone where it's 55 dBA.
As I understand, that is the same for the Remarkables Park zone and also the Frankton Flats zone.
Well, I'm not really worried about those zones because they're not in stage one. I'm are dealing with the zones that we have before us.
Yes,
and it just seems to me that, in my experience, most plans deal with noise, like the airport, which you say, you say within the zone, the 835 dBA, but when it's received outside the zone, it's the same, consistent with all other noises in the receiving environment. It seems strange that if there's a noise issue in the residential zone, that someone monitoring it has to decide where the source is to determine whether it's breaching the noise limits or not. It seems a rather difficult and impractical thing to do.
I'm not sure I can take it much further other than to say, as I understand, that it's consistent with the designation and also the approach taken in other zones around the airport, so it's not an anomaly in that regard, other than obviously the residential zone.
Yeah, well, we haven't, A, the remote dispatch zone is not included, and B, we haven't got to the business zones yet. But if they are written the same way, I'd be asking the same question as to why they are allowed to have more noise in that sense.
As I understand it, the remarkable spark zone may not be included in the district plan review at all. I'm not sure if the final decision has been made on that, but I understand that.
I have that hope as well.
Might mean that this hearing wraps up a bit sooner. But if that is the case, then the merits of the approach and the remarkable spark zone can't be assessed through this process.
But there is still some low-density residential land that could be affected by the airport of Tucson noise that was out there.
In the fracton?
Yes. Yes, between the airport and the lake, essentially. Okay. I've got a couple of other matters for your submissions. I'd just like to raise with you. In your discussion regarding this, the definition of utility, incorporating network utility operators and the effect that would have on the buildings, etc., in the airport, is it a simpler solution to amend the definition?
And exclude airports from it?
That was my thought, and I raised that yesterday with council officers.
Yes,
as well.
That is one way of addressing it.
I like simple solutions rather than complicated series of rules.
Well, I don't think you're going to find a simple solution for this chapter, unfortunately. The more you, what Mr. Sullivan and I have found, is the more you delve into it, the messier it becomes. And we have turned our mind to whether just omitting or excluding airports from the definition of utilities would be one way of addressing this. And it could be.
In the operative plan, that provision is not included in the definition of utilities. So the real question is, has it created a problem for the airport to date?
Well, I think the answer is no, in terms of the operative provisions. The only consequence of, so to say, first consequence for the airport of excluding people assuming from the definition of utilities is that the airport would be not able to benefit of those provisions for infrastructure it seeks to establish outside.
Well, I don't think that's correct, because the definition of utilities is, I'm not going to get it now, so I was looking at it yesterday, the list in the definition is only an inclusive list, and it's not the absolute limit. And it is, in fact, the opening words of the definition that determine whether a matter is a utility or not. The includes are just a series of examples. And I think that the opening definition would capture those utility aspects of the airport, such as navigation aids, meteorological stations, etc., in any event. And it would exclude the terminal and those sorts of facilities, which I suspect is what the airport company's concern is.
Well, if that's the case, then yes, I agree that one way of dealing with this issue is to exclude airports from the definition.
I think the definition is possibly unnecessary in any event, because the definition of utility captures network utility operators in any event, without specifically saying the only thing you can do that might help the council may be concerned is to exclude other people other than network utility operators from operating utilities, but that's a different matter. And I don't think that's what the definition does. On page 234. Sixth and seventh bullet points, they capture the BORs, the meteorological stations,
Mr. Sullivan, the difficulty is, well, whilst we've got to move on like this group, is that the definition of equal or related activities is broad and includes some of these activities that are listed here. So you create this inconsistency where on the one hand you say it excludes.
But isn't that the situation with the operating plan?
The definition of equal and related activities is new.
And then maybe then when we deal with that in the business end, we should make sure that we don't have that problem with the two definitions. But I suspect that it's not such a problem.
Perhaps it's something that Mr. Salman and I need to give some further thought to if the airports are to be excluded, what consequential amendments would need to be made to other provisions? Where we have got to.
Well, the other question is too, is given that the airport's designation is contiguous with the airport mixed use zone, are there any airport related utility functions that would occur within the airport mixed use zone that wouldn't be within the realms of the designation?
Yes, there are. I think, as I understand it, the airport mixed use zone is larger, includes more land than the designation.
The maps don't appear as such.
QAT's made a provision that the airport mixes used to be extended slightly.
That's lots.
Yeah, sure, Mr. Sullivan, just to introduce you on this.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of an eye.
Could you explain that loud enough so you can hear it on the recording?
So
The airport mixed-use zone includes maybe three or four parcels of land on the south
west.
Southwest of Lucas Place, and they are not designated for airport purposes, and those are the only few parcels.
Are they QAC in the
No.
So, would QAC be putting utilities on them?
Utilities which would be the benefit of this
cessation. Well, other utilities can't use
QFC's designation. Well, that's right. That's
going to
be my answer.
Related to that, do QAC have designations that aren't contiguous with the airport for where they put other?
No, they're subject to the. They need to go to resource and to the subject zone, the particular zone.
Yeah, right. So
there's no others out.
No.
It's just anything else is the ones I'm thinking of, the thing on top of the hill is that civil aviation zone.
Yeah, some of that infrastructure is civil aviation.
Right, but
even if it's QAC's, it would be subject to the zone provisions. Its designation is on the ground around the airport and also the airspace around the airport.
Right.
It's not somewhere else. So, Mr. Salazar and I will give some further thought to how we can tie this up in a better way, and perhaps the time to address it is at the Chapter 17 hearing. Where we had got to was we formed a view that the most straightforward way to deal with this is clarification note, because it simply means you exclude Chapter 17 from the provisions of this chapter, the utilities chapter. Everything else on the land around the airport is still subject to the provisions of Chapter 30. And then you don't get this situation where you have to amend definitions or so forth and think about consequential changes and implications on other activities. It seemed to us to be the most straightforward way of dealing with it. We did give it quite some thought.
What would be the situation, though, if you had some other utility, network utility operator or whatever, wanting to put something in the airport mixed use zone?
Yes.
Then they wouldn't be able to rely on the...
Yes, well, that's from 30.
And
yeah.
How would that work?
That's right, they wouldn't. But the definition of airport and airport-related activities is broad and would capture those... other utilities that are foreseeable would foreseeably want to or need to establish within the airport mixed use zone.
So all the telecommunication companies would be happy with that. Discuss that with them. The obvious utility that would like to put things in airports.
Activity includes servicing and infrastructure. Infrastructure isn't defined in the proposed plan, but it is defined in the Act, and it's defined broadly. And it's defined in a way which generally, and not entirely, but generally encapsulates everything that's defined as a utility in the proposed plan.
But it says provided they serve an aviation-related purpose, retail. And it also says that provides support to the airport.
The
airport's land is a perfect place to provide cell phone coverage for the Markham's Park.
The provided they serve an aviation-related purpose relates to the medical facilities and education facilities. So there's no such limit on servicing and infrastructure.
Well, these are what the opening words are. Needs an ancillary activity or service that provides the service. So provides support to the airport. This includes, so it has to meet that first sentence. And I would have thought, yes, if a cell phone tower was specifically oriented to passengers or people at the airport, that's fine, but given that it's actually a rather small area, I'm curious to keep it on there.
Yes, I take it.
Yes, and we are going to have quite a bit of time, but you asked for sufficient time to take us through till after lunch, and it may be that we end up that you could actually have a discussion with Ms. O'Sullivan.
Yes. Well, she probably thinks she can go on for the next 2 minutes.
The other question I've got relates to this issue of dispute between Dr. Childs and Mr. Day and your legal submissions on whether on pages 17 and 18 on the measurement report. As I understand, your submission is that the plan by saying 1 to 2 metres gives an option, and that it is within scope to set it at 2 metres but not at 1 metre. Now, have you considered the possibility that the 1 to 2 metres requires measurement at all points within 1 to 2 metres rather than at any point, which I suspect is what your submission is based on?
Yes, that is what my submission is based on. And I can't see that that could be a logical interpretation, because if you need a point, if the measurement is to be at all points between one and at all points between and including 1 to 2 metres, then why have 2 metres? Because if you comply at 1 metre, of course you're going to have to comply at 2 metres, because the further you get away from the resource, the quieter the less the measurement's going to be. So I can't see that that could be a logical interpretation of the 1 to 2 metres.
Yeah, I've thought about this too, and I agree that it seems illogical, but you consider that if the vent is in the ceiling, for example, you effectively have, and if we take it as a point rather than a square, because it's easier to understand, but you actually have a ball with a radius of 1 metre and cut it in half, put it over that, that is one, and do 1 to 2, and you end up with an area. There will be points right up by the ceiling where probably the noise is actually not as loud at 1 metre as it is directly below it, because it doesn't radiate because of the nature of the thing. And I'm sure that Mr. Day would agree that we don't just go to one point on the 2 metres or 1 metre and say that's the noise, you checked that there isn't variation. So I'm not convinced that's a single point issue, and we may not have the scope to change it is the real point. It's not well drafted. I don't know that your option necessarily provides us with the scope to change it.
If your view is that there is no scope, then QRC would accept that, provided it's we're not getting to Mr. Charles's recommendation, which has the potential to be more onerous than what's already there.
Dr. Charles' evidence was that the difference could be as much as 5 decibels, and that is a significant difference. And I want to discuss with Mr. Day whether there's a practical solution. We, of course, can recommend variations to fix these things which are out of scope, so we're interested in seeing if there's a sensible outcome that we can suggest.
Yeah, so I anticipate the variation may well be required for chapter 36. And as you'll be aware, QAC didn't expressly submit on this measurement distance issue, and was happy to see, well, not happy, but I suppose just to decide to expressly and on that basis, the 1 to 2 metre requirement would be carried over into the proposed plan. Mr. Dan, looking at it, has reached a view of create some ambiguity, and it would be an opportune time to tidy it up. Yes, and so he can address you on I suppose the reasons for that, for the detail, to the scope. If your view is that there is no scope to alter it through this process, then so be it. That's consistent with QAC's original submission. The science behind it can be considered perhaps if there is to be a variation.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, so Mr. Roberts has prepared a summary of his evidence. Yeah.
Senior Building Services Engineer and Director of Jackson Engineering Devices Limited. I confirm that I have read the Environmental Court's Code of Conduct for Expert Witnesses and have prepared my evidence in accordance with it. Specifically, I confirm that the issues addressed are within my area of expertise. I have not omitted to consider any material facts known to me that might alter or detract from the opinions I express. The Queenstown Airport Corporation, QAC, has lodged submissions on Chapter 36. My evidence is in connection with proposed Rule 36.6.3, Table 5. The submissions seek to amend the proposed Rule 36.6.3, Table 5, because it is unsatisfactory in its notified form. As notified, proposed Rule 36.6.3, Table 5, is the same as Appendix 13, Table 2 of the operative district plan. From my review work of the requirements of Appendix 13 and Table 2 of the OEP, it has become apparent that there are a number of practical difficulties with implementing and financial implications of using a mechanical ventilation system in accordance with the operative and hence notified rule. More particularly, it has become apparent that in a climate such as Queenstown, strict compliance with the rule may result in the need for large ventilation systems with multiple fans and heating systems, and it does not satisfactorily address thermal comfort in summer. There is general agreement between QAC and QLDC as to how proposed Rule 36.6.3, Table 5 should be redrafted, subject to matters of detail. I generally support the recommendations of Dr. Childs, including his reformatting of the proposed rule as set out in his evidence and Appendix 1 of the Section 42A report, but consider that some additional requirements are required to ensure the rule is clear, unambiguous, and practical to implement. The further requirements I consider are required relate to the minimum and maximum air change requirements, ensuring ventilation system heats as well as cools, ensuring the ventilation system includes an airway path, ensuring the rule clarifies that existing plant may be used to achieve compliance, and other minor matters of clarification. Proposed Rule 36.6.3, as set out in Appendix 1 of Section 42A report, is not dissimilar to Option 2 in Annex D of QAC submission. and with further amendments summarised above and detailed more fully in my primary evidence, would be a preferable alternative in my opinion. Provided all of my recommended amendments are made, option 2 in Annexure D of QAC's submission could then be deleted. I consider my recommended amendments to the rule will address the difficulties encountered with operative mechanical ventilation requirements and hence the notified rule, while at the same time providing residents with an appropriate level of indoor comfort and amenity. I consider the alternative options being either the notified rule or the section 42A revision of it will likely be more costly to implement with no real additional benefit and will be less efficient and effective. I have read the evidence summaries of Ruth Evans, the section 42A report writer, and Dr. Charles, and briefed the comments as follows. I agree with Dr. Charles' recommendation for a low setting airflow of 0.5 air changes per hour, and note it is consistent with my original recommendation as per Annexure D of QAC's submission. However, I do not agree that 0.5 air changes per hour should be stated as a minimum requirement, as suggested by Dr. Charles' words, at least 0.5 air changes, because the high setting of 5 air changes per hour would achieve that. The point of the low setting is to enable the building occupier to turn the ventilation down. In respect of Ms. Evans' points at paragraph 8b of her summary, I note the purpose of my recommendation for a heating function is to address the circumstances where a homeowner uses ventilation in otherwise unheated spaces, thus driving indoor space temperatures downwards below recommended minimums, particularly an issue in the winter. To address this, the recommendation of my evidence is that the system be required to maintain the temperature of the ventilated room at 18 degrees C, as distinct from heating the room or entire building to a higher temperature. I maintain this is appropriate, particularly in a climate such as Queenstown. In his point 8D, Dr. Childs appears to have misunderstood the point of my recommendation. To clarify, I have stated in my evidence that in the event that summer cooling is provided by a ventilation system, which would most likely be a heat pump, then a higher ventilation rate is not desirable because it is the heat pump which is providing the cooling function. Whenever the outdoor temperature is greater than the indoor temperature, the incoming hot outdoor air will be working against the heat pump cooling and reducing its effect. To avoid this situation from arising, I have recommended the rule clarify that where a heat pump is provided, the required ventilation rate remains at the low ventilation rate of 0.5 air changes per hour. This does not avoid ventilation requirements but limits the rate of ventilation, as it is not necessary, and I've actually struck out the word necessary and replaced it with desirable.
Thank you. I just had a matter of clarification on your original draft of evidence on page 10. And that's 20 top of the page there. The little 3, and you talk about targets and minimum room temperature of 25 degrees. I just wondered if minimum was the correct word.
Yes, I can see perhaps sort of those words are those that. Ruth Evans has included in her 42A report. So, if those, I presume that they've been transcribed correctly. However, the point of that is to provide a comfortable environment that's not too hot, so as to reduce the temperature to 25 degrees C, but it does not need to reduce it any further than that. 25 degrees C being an upper limit of comfort. I guess the point is that it's primarily used as a ventilation system to replace what would otherwise be some cooling effect from opening the windows.
So what I'm understanding you're saying is that is the point at which there's an obligation for ventilation purposes is to achieve 25 degrees if the occupier chooses to have a cooler, that's their choice, but it's not the ventilation system responsibility.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Just one, in regard to 14A on the summary there, I just want to clarify that what you're saying is you don't need to say that there is at least 0.5 air changes, it's just that there are 0.5 air changes and that's it.
That's correct.
That's
my recommendation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Inappropriate land use planning around airports allowing residential encroachment exposes communities to the adverse effects of aircraft noise and exposes the airport operator to potential reverse sensitivity effects. As the standard NZ6805, Airport Noise Management and Land Use Planning, provides councils with a consistent approach to noise planning around New Zealand airports with a goal to minimise these adverse effects. The standard uses the noise boundary concept as a mechanism for local authorities to A, establish compatible land use planning around an airport, and B, set noise limits for the management of aircraft noise at airports. In 1995, airport noise boundaries were introduced into the Queenstown Lakes District Plan based on the recommendations within the NZS 6805. The airport operational projections were updated in 2007 with associated noise contours. These contours were adopted in PC 35, and PC 35 was subsequently confirmed by the Council and the Environment Court. The operative Queenstown Lakes District Plan, as amended by PC 35, includes land use controls for a number of zones which are affected by aircraft noise associated with the OCB and the ANB for Queenstown Airport. The ODP also specifies noise mitigation in the form of sound insulation and mechanical ventilation in certain situations. As notified, the PDP incorporates some of these provisions and amends others. QAC made submissions on the PDP. My evidence primarily addresses its submission on the mechanical ventilation requirements. I also comment on proposed changes to the sound insulation requirements and very generally addresses some other provisions in Chapter 36 which I consider may require amendments to ensure they are clear and workable. Specifically, A, I agree with the proposal to upgrade the airport-related ventilation requirements in Table 5 to include air conditioning. This provides a fair opportunity for occupants to keep their windows closed and thus avoid the effects of airport noise. I agree with Mr. Roberts' recommendation to remove the reference to Clause G4 of the Building Code as recommended by Dr. Charles, though I see he's later agreed to that removal, from these ventilation requirements to avoid confusion. I recommend the measurement distance for noise from these ventilation systems should be 2 metres to remove the ambiguity in the notified rule. This measurement distance accords with the closest point to the system from where noise from systems will likely be heard. I agree the specified sound insulation constructions in Rule 3662, Table 4, should be amended to provide for common double glazing configurations as recommended by Dr. Charles. I have made a number of comments on drafting ambiguities in the Chapter 36 noise rules, including the issue of the zoning of the noise source and the location of the noise receiver.
Can you deal with this issue of the 1 metre, 2 metres?
Sure.
I know from your substantive evidence that you suggest 2 metres because if it's in the ceiling, they'll be 2 metres away from it. And Dr. Charles prefaced his comments on the rule as that it was to protect sleep rather than daytime noise. Is it possible that if people are putting in ventilation systems which heat in this district, they also put them in to vent at low wall level or floor level?
Yes, there certainly are low-wall heat pump units available that do the heating and the cooling. They're basically just the high-wall units in a floor-mounted unit. I mean, I have a high-mounted one in my bedroom, and I'm probably 4 metres to 5 metres from its location in the sleeping position. Generally, I would imagine that people wouldn't be any closer than 2 metres to a low wall unit as well, because you don't want to get the drafts, in, particularly in the summer when it's in cooling. You want it to be generally cooling the whole room rather than being in the direct flow and be that close. So I would imagine in most situations you've got to be 2 metres away from a low wall unit as well, as an absolute minimum, probably more. I think just following on from Ms. Walt's comments on what does the operative plan mean, the one to two metres, if it meant 1 and 2 metres, both of them have to comply, you would just never specify the two in there, you'd just specify one. So I
think it's ambiguous.
Yeah.
And 1 to 2, it sort of implies that you choose a location that's suitable within 1 to 2, but that I don't think is what the rule really intends.
Yeah.
So I understand the problem with it.
Yes, it's, I think it's just an accidental error.
Okay. The other question I had. Paragraph 50, you talk about the duplication there of the rules from Queenstown and Wanaka Airports. I understand that. I'm wondering whether in the rural zones, I know that we've already heard, but because we question anyway, there is a distinction there made in chapter 21 between the two control boundaries. In your view, is there any reason to distinguish between how noise is dealt with within an out-of-control boundary between the two airports?
No, it's not really the difference between the two airports that I was meaning in my paragraph 50, but to answer your question, I can't see any reason why from sort of look of actual rules, why there should be any difference between the two airports. It's really the that, by the way, there's a type of grammatical error in the paragraph 50, my paragraph 50, that 36 should read then 36.3.2.8.
Yes.
Of course. So, so it's really those two, that 3.2.8 says that the limits in table 2 do not apply to operations at Queenstown or Wanaka. And then my point really was that then down in table 1 at 36.4.6 it says again sounds from aircraft operations, aircraft movements within the designated airport shall be excluded as well. So it just seemed to be a duplication that you're excluding it twice, but I mean it's a really minor issue. But to answer your question, I don't think that in terms of the exclusion from the noise controls that there should be any difference between Wanaka or Queenstown airports.
Okay. Well, the other matter that I raised was,
yes,
what was to do with the different noise levels in the receiving environment from the airport mixed use zone versus noise that may come from some other zone into, for example, the low density residential, where on one hand it's saying 50, or on the other hand it's saying 55 dBA.
Yes.
Is that, in a practical sense, easy to monitor?
On that practical side first, it's actually essential that you have to establish where the noise source is coming from, because if it's a compliance issue in any noise compliance situation, if it's going to involve a prosecution or whatever, you absolutely have to be clear on what the noise source is. So that's a normal part of our job. We spend a large amount of training our young engineers on when they go out to do a noise survey, that they're actually measuring the noise from a known source, but it can't be corrupted by traffic noise, or if there's two industrial noise sources that are exceeding the noise limit, you have to do some clever techniques to establish exactly which one is contributing how much, and that can involve switching on and off and that sort of thing. So it's absolutely essential from a compliance point of view that you do establish what the noise source is, where the noise is coming from, in any noise compliance situation.
Then the next question is, in your experience around the country, is it common for the receiving environment to have different levels of acceptable noise perception, say for residential areas, depending on the zoning of the source?
It is slightly unusual to do it in that way, but it is common practice for certain receiving environments to get different noise levels from different sources. And just to give you a little background, the reasoning behind this one is that the residential areas around the airport, close to the airport, are already significantly affected by noise levels greater than 55 due to aircraft operations. So the residential areas that surround the airport multi-use zone are generally inside the 55 contour, and so they're exposed to moderate to high levels of aircraft operational noise. And just looking at the 55 is actually a more normal control around the rest of the country, and 50 is lower. They probably splits about 50-50, 50%, 50% are half of them, 55 around the country and half are 50. So it's not abnormal to have a 55. But just following the concept of the affected areas around there, normally around the airports, the activities going on in the mixed use zone are engine testing and aircraft maintenance and all that sort of thing. And at most other airports, there are specific engine testing rules that do allow a higher level of noise on the surrounding residential areas than a residential area further away from the airport. That is fairly normal practice, and there are specific engine testing rules. During the PC35 hearing, that was actually proposed as a way of dealing with these noises from within this mixed use zone, particularly specifically the maintenance and engine testing. But the commissioners in that case decided that it was more sensible to put an exemption in for the testing of jet engines, because they happen very infrequently, and put a more normal control in for general maintenance activity at 55 dB for normal maintenance and activity and testing of engines. So that's where that sort of that approach came from, and then that seems to have been reflected in this rather unusual way of the way the tables were written to reflect the receiving zone. So it does appear an inconsistency that one source is allowed to make this kind of noise, whereas another source has to make less noise.
Well, and that's answered another query that I raised yesterday that I hadn't realised. So the 55 dBA does incorporate some aviation related activities, albeit ground based, is that correct?
That's my understanding, but I might check with Ms. Walt in terms of are there any other specific in other chapters specific rules relating to engine testing? Right. So within the noise contours, the OCB and the ANB, that includes basically aircraft and the activity of taking off and landing, and the latest set of the updated contours of PC35 included taxiing as well, but that's the only land-based activity. So engine testing and maintenance is not included in any of the boundaries.
Yeah. Even startup.
No, startup potentially. Well, it's probably included in the taxing.
So
yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Now the other question I had was this minor grammatical dispute between you and Dr. Charles over whether we use sound in some places and noise in the other.
Yeah.
And I just wondered whether there is a distinction. When I play Led Zeppelin at 100 decibels, I consider it sound. My wife considers it noise. Is that a description?
That is a fairly succinct description of the difference between the two. Mm-hmm. I mean, sound is the larger set, and then that covers them all, and then noise is basically defined as unwanted sound. So under sound, you've got wanted sound and unwanted sound, are the two categories. And it becomes a fairly philosophical, and it's a minor issue, and I raise it generally. Most district plans just refer to noise. The problem, as Dr. Charles pointed out, is that the standards are written by some theoreticians who say it should be environmental sound rather than environmental noise, because some people might like it. So,
I'm sure there are people who love listening to hear about that.
I've
seen videos of them staying dependent.
That's
on
right. Yeah, absolutely. And there's some people who love wind farms and some who don't. So, yeah. So I think it's a fun drafting issue, but I'll leave you with.
One question, just about the 1 metre and 2 metre.
Yes.
Is there, from a pragmatic point of view, ever going to be a solution where we say, well, 1.5 metres, or is it a point of difference that's too extreme to find any common ground?
I mean, that would be a pragmatic solution. You just have to check that it's... certainly some of the existing heat pump units, I doubt that they can actually comply at 1 metre. The later ones, more modern ones, tend to be quieter and possibly can comply at 1 metre and possibly 1.5 metres, but certainly some of the older ones, I doubt it. But 1.5 would be a compromise if there's scope to do that. As Dr. Child pointed out, the difference is about 5 dB, and it'll be about 2.5 dB, which is not a huge amount. Whereas, as Commissioner Newsom said, it's 5 dB is noticeable and potentially significant in terms of compliance, but 2.5 is getting down to the order of magnitude that's only just as small.
But it also assuming that the longer you have a unit,
They tend to become a little noisier as the filters dust up, and it's working a bit harder. But as long as it's maintained, okay, they should be alright. It just tends to be the old technology versus the new. Yeah.
And just with regard to the jet engine noise, as a small aside, we screen Topka and outdoor and as a movie in Wallachia. And the police thought it was fantastic, but the neighbours didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, well, that's noise versus sound.
No, it was the sound.
Absolutely. Excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Day.
Okay.
Mr. Ball, I'm just wondering whether the raised issues that you want to discuss with Mr. Sullivan, whether we give you some time, to discuss those with him, if you could present them as part of his summary.
Yes.
Would that be a sensible idea?
Yes.
Brilliant. How much time would you like?
We need that.
Conceivably, we'd have it until 12:30, because I can't imagine it would be more than half an hour as well. Have a look at them, as I saw them today.
Yes.
In case I'll return until 11:00.